To this point, I'm just going to review a little bit. We have finished Act 1 of the drama that is called Job. And I've tried to emphasize two particular thoughts, two verses that really are key if we are going to understand the message of the book of Job. The first verse was in chapter 1, verse 9, where as God drew Satan's attention to Job and says, look at Job, here's a blameless, upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. And in verse 9, Satan answers God and says, I've noticed Job. He says, but here's the big question. Does Job fear God for nothing? Okay? Doesn't he fear God, in other words? Doesn't he fear you, God, Satan is saying, because of what it gets him in life? It gets him a happy family in which all of his children get along well. They even party together. I mean, imagine that, siblings partying together regularly. A vast wealth, as we saw in verse 3. Job's getting that out of you, God. A great standing and reputation, verse 3. And then praise from God himself comes to Job. That's what verse 8 shows. Job's getting a lot from you, God, Satan is saying. Does not he fear God because of what he's getting? Does not he fear you because of what you are protecting him from? You're protecting him from that lack of well-being. You're protecting him from a loss of fame and a loss of wealth. You're protecting him from your wrath. Well, of course Job is going to fear you. This is a business relationship. He's fearing you for what he can get out of you. And you're giving to him because of what you want to get out of him. That's Satan's big question here. Does Job fear God for nothing? And so his suggestion is, his charge, his accusation actually is, that the relationship between God and Job, and therefore between God and anyone who would profess to be trusting God, Satan is saying, no, that relationship is based on a, you make me happy, I'll make you happy type of situation. You tickle my ego, God's saying, I'll tickle your pocketbook. That's Satan's charge. And it's a pretty major charge, isn't it? But we've also seen that his accusation is pretty much struck down by the fact that Job remained faithful throughout his initial trials here in chapters 1 into the first part of chapter 2. And that just destroys Satan's accusations. The other verse that I tried to emphasize and I hope you've picked up on is in chapter 2, verse 3. After God allowed Satan to take away all that Job possesses, except his wife, then we find God brings Job to Satan's attention again. And this time, when God speaks in chapter 2, verse 3, he says, look, Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him. He's just like he was before you brought your accusation. But then he says, there's no one like him, a blameless, upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. All that is what God could describe Job before this all started. But then he says, and he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause. And it's those last two words that are so important for us to realize. God is saying, everything that has happened to Job, his loss of all his possessions, his loss of his health, his complete lack of comfort, his pain, everything that we described as graphically as I dared last week, that has happened to Job without cause. In other words, nothing Job did brought that on to him. That's God's statement. And that should really affect the way we view our situations in life. But now, with those two verses in mind and those two emphases in mind, at this point, the plot thickens. Another act opens here in chapter 2, verse 11. And we have, actually it'll end up being four new characters who add a whole dimension to this. As we approach this, we need to understand something. We need to remember that we know both what's going on in heaven and what's going on earth. We have been given that picture here in the first 1.5 chapters of Job. But we've got to remember that Job only has one picture. He only has the picture of the experiences that he has endured while on earth. He has no clue of what has been happening in heaven. He has no clue of what Satan has accused him and God of doing, of having that business relationship. Job has no clue about that. He has no clue that God has told Satan that all that has happened to Job has happened to Job without cause, without anything that Job has done to deserve it. Job doesn't know what happened in heaven. The friends that we're about to meet don't know what happened in heaven. They only know what they've heard about what happened to Job on this earth. It's very important that we keep in our minds the realization that we know because we've been told here in Scripture, but they don't know. Okay, so as we come to scene one of this second act, and by the way, somebody has a microphone, so if you've got something to say or a question to ask, it'll be getting to you, and already we have one. Where's the mic? Okay, thank you, Mike. Double mic here.
I wonder what happened is Job know that God is the one give the devil permission to suffer in that way.
Job does not know.
But what happened is he know.
I'm not sure I understand what you're asking.
I wonder what happened is Job know.
Does Job know? If Job knew, we're not told. We can't know. Yeah, that's hypothetical, so we can't answer that. Yeah. That's not the point. Okay, I think is another way of putting it. And it's very important that we not put into this book what isn't there, because it's what's there that God has given for us. So let's not hypothesize about things that did not happen. That's going to get us into trouble in missing the point of what did happen. So I would very much urge that we stick with that, okay? Chapter 2, verse 11. Job's friends arrive. They hear, verse 11 tells us, they hear about Job's situation. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, news always travels fast, doesn't it? They came, each one from his own place. So they come from their, they don't live near each other, it sounds like. They come from their different places, and we are given some suggestions as to where their places were. There's Eliphaz, the Temanite. He has the same name as Esau's son, who had a son named Teman, in Genesis 36, verses 4 and 11. There are two possible locations for Teman, or Teman, if you want to call it that. There's a Teman in the land of Edom, which would be basically east and a little bit south of what we would think of as the land of Israel. And then there's a Tema in Arabia as well, which would be south, much further south, but also east of Israel as we know it. So it's somewhere down in that area. We don't have a precise location in mind. Then there's Bildad, the Shuhite. Perhaps he's related to Abraham's youngest son, whose name was Shua in Genesis 25, verse 2. We don't know for sure, but that's a guess. We don't know where he lived. And Zophar the Naamathite is the third friend that is named here in verse 11. They somehow send word to each other, make an appointment to meet together, and come to visit Job. And notice their purpose. They're also in verse 11. They made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and to comfort him. We need to begin our discussion of them because we're going to criticize these guys quite a bit, okay? I mean, that's just a given because they're dead wrong in much of what they're doing. But we need to start out by realizing that they really cared. They really cared for Job. They were the ones that were willing to come and visit him. in the midst of his despair. They really cared because, as we're going to see in the next two verses, verses 12 and 13, they recognized that there was a time for silence. And that shows a lot about how much they cared, that they didn't just come in yakking away. Okay, they cared because they spoke to Job, not behind his back. That shows how much they cared for their friend, Job, in the midst of his pain. They did not make their accusations to somebody else. No, they made them right to Job. And they cared, finally, we could say, because they remained friends of Job. They thought he was a horrible sinner. They didn't know what he had done, but they were sure he was a sinner. But they were still his friends. So we need to recognize that they really cared. And in fact, verse 12 tells us that they mourned because of Job's situation. When they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him, they raised their voices and wept, and each of them tore his robe, threw dust over their heads toward the sky. Those are all outward expressions of deep sorrow and much mourning. By the way, you notice that Job was so affected by his illness that they couldn't tell who he was from a distance. Okay, we dealt with his physical maladies last week, but that's one thing that needs to be pointed out here. And then coming to verse 13, we find that these friends sit with Job in silence for 7 days. And it's a silence that is brought on by their recognition of the intense pain. I would suggest not merely physical pain. We're going to see it's far more emotional and spiritual pain that he's feeling. And they have the sense to keep their mouths shut for 7 days. Just sit there and watch. I imagine the tears must have run down their faces as they watched him writhe in agony, as they watched him struggle with all of this. But I'm trying to give us hints as far as how to minister, too. What would there be to say at a time like that? You just walk into the house. What is there to say? Sometimes it's best just to say nothing. Job knew they cared by the fact that they were willing. Hopefully his wife was a good cook. But he knew by the fact that they were willing to just be there, doing, saying nothing. He knew they cared. Okay, then we come to chapter 3. And this has got to be one of the most raw chapters, if not the most raw chapter in the Bible. There is something here that, I don't know about you, but it just freezes me to hear how he puts things and to see the depth of his despair. Job is expressing his pain, and that's all this chapter is Job expressing his pain because of what he has been experiencing. And I'm going to read what somebody else, David Clines, has written about this chapter to try and help give you a sense of what's going on here, because I'm afraid that too often we might try to put too much into this chapter, and we might not get what is really there. Klein says this: "It is amazing to find here, speaking of Job 3, not one strictly theological sentence, not a single question about the meaning of his suffering, not a hint that it may be deserved, not the slightest nod to the doctrine of retribution. All that will come in time, but here we are invited to view the man Job in the violence of his grief." Boy, that's a good way to describe it. Job is expressing the violence of his grief. "Unless we encounter this man with these feelings, we have no right to listen in on the debates that follow. With this speech before us, we cannot over-intellectualize the book, but must always be reading it as the drama of a human soul." The point is, Job isn't asking any questions here to speak of. Job is just simply saying, "I hurt. I'm hurting. Life has got me in its grip, and I don't like it. I just don't like it." So with that introduction in mind, let's see what he actually does say. The first 10 verses are Job saying, I wish I had never existed. And so verse 3 is where he begins to speak. And he says, let the day perish on which I was to be born, and the night which said, a boy is conceived. That's the essence of his message here in verses 3 through 10. That's what he's expressing in all of these verses, is I wish the day would perish that I was to be born, and I wish the night would have perished when I was conceived. I wish it had never happened, in other words. And then he expands on those two curses. He expands the curse on his birthday in verses 4 and 5. May that day, the day I was born, be darkness. Let not God above care for it, nor light shine on it. Let darkness and black gloom claim it. Let a cloud settle on it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. Man, this guy really knows how to speak, doesn't he? But he's just simply making that point. I wish I had never been born. And then verses 6 through 10, is where he expands his curse on the night of his conception. He says in verse 6, cross it off the calendar. Cross that night off. As for that night, let darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Verse 7, he says, I wish that night had been unproductive. In other words, I wish I had not been conceived that night. Let that night be barren. Let no joyful shout enter it. And then verses 8 and 9, he goes a step further. He says, let it be cursed that night I was conceived. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are prepared to rouse Leviathan. Let the stars of its twilight be darkened. Let it wait for light but have none. Let it not see the breaking dawn, because it did not shut the opening of my mother's womb. That night did not prevent my conception, so curse that night, Job is saying. His pain is really something. Really something. And that's what he's expressing. But Job has not lost touch with reality. And he knows that he can't make his conception and birth disappear. He knows that he can't make that happen. So what does he do? Well, in verses 11 through 19, he says, well, okay, I wish I had died before I was born. I wish I had died at birth. Because, again, he would not have had to experience what he's experiencing in life. So in verses 11 and 12, he says, I wish I had been stillborn. Why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me, and why the breasts that I should suck? He's longing for the peace and the rest that he would be enjoying if he had died at birth. And that's what he says in verse 13 and following. He says, if I had died when I was born, now I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept then. I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, with princes who had gold, who were filling their houses with silver. Then in verse 16, he's saying, I wish I had been miscarried and thrown out, miscarried and disposed of. Because if I had, I'd be where the wicked cease from raging, where the weary are at rest, verse 17. Where the prisoners are at ease together. They don't hear the voice of their taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. In other words, if I was in the grave, I would be with all those whose trials of life are done. So I wish I were dead. And he's wishing that he, since he knows he can't have that wish, you know, he can't go back to his birth and die. So verse 20, he wishes for something else. He wishes he could die right now. I wish I could die right here, right now. And so he asks, verse 20, why is light given to him who suffers? Why is life given to the bitter soul who long for death, but there is none, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures? Can I point something out here? I think I'm not going to develop it anymore. I'm going to make an observation. Job is longing for death, but you will not find a hint here that the option of suicide is even to be considered. Okay? He just wants to be dead. Then verse 22, he expresses the joy that death brings to those who desire it, who rejoice greatly and exult when they find the grave. There are a lot of people like this, by the way. They might not be as deep into it as Job is, but there's a lot of people who feel this way. Verse 23, he expresses his frustration with his circumstances of life. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? I don't understand, Job's saying. I don't understand why I have to endure what I'm going through. For my groaning comes at the sight of my food, and my cries pour out like water. His frustration with his circumstances of life, in which mealtimes are times of groaning, times of crying. The food doesn't please him, for sure. Verse 25, his fears are constantly being realized. What I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I can't imagine anything worse than what I'm already going through. All of my fears are being experienced, Job is saying. And then verse 26, I have no comfort, no peace, no rest, only agitation. I'm not at ease, nor am I quiet. I am not at rest, but turmoil comes. Have you ever heard anyone talk like this? Wow. Cheryl.
In verse 23, I'm not sure I understand what that means. Whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in, meaning God has protected that individual?
No.
What does
God
that
has
mean?
Put him in a corner.
Okay.
He can't get out of it.
Okay.
God has put circumstances in his life that he cannot escape. Yeah. Some hedges are protection, some hedges are... And they might sometimes be the same hedges. We just don't see that always. Now notice that Job is not really asking any theological questions here, just like David Klein said. He's simply crying out in pain. But there are, I think, a lot of implications here for anyone who might wish to comfort, for anyone who might wish to empathize, for anyone who might wish to help him as a friend. With this kind of, you know, hearing this kind of expression, what would best help him right now? What would these three friends, Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, what would be good for them to be doing once they've heard this 7 days into their time with Job, after 7 days?
I don't know if I get the question, but... When I read this book, what I find out is the good thing that did the friends is when they say, don't do that. Remember, you help us, now we help you. That's what the friends did to Joe. So I think that's what I can say. You know, the good thing they did is they told him they don't give up.
Oh, but, I wish that's what they had told him. That's not what they told him, though.
Well, I guess I misunderstood.
Yeah, we'll get into their speeches, but they did not say, stick with it, Job. That's not at all what they were saying. But I'll explain that as we go, okay?
So, but I got a question in this part. You know, when he wished he never born or be alive in this world, do he know he's against God's will?
No, he's not expressing anything against God's will.
But
he's just saying how much he hurts. That's why I say we can't bring theological questions. He's not expressing that God was wrong. He's just simply saying, I wish I had never been born. And there is that difference. Later on, he's going to make some mistakes. But at this stage, he's just saying how badly he hurts.
Because when I read this book, I find out too.
Yeah, but we can't read the rest of the book and put that back into this chapter. We've got to take it as it is here at this point in his life.
But hold on a sec. When I read this chapter, I find out that I never hear nobody curse anything like he did right here. And
yeah.
It got in my mind why he did it.
He did it because he hurt.
Because I never hear nobody curse anything like that, you know what I mean?
No, I agree. I haven't either. Except for Job, yeah.
It appears that he's still questioning God's purpose for that. I mean, that God put him there. So he's kind of the. I guess the question is he's questioning God's purpose. Why God allowed him to be born in that situation?
It appears, but see, that's because we are reading that into this. That's my whole point. We cannot be reading that into this at this stage. That'll come, but it's not here in chapter 3. He's just simply saying, I've had all I can take. I wish I had never been born.
And then you said we can't bring theological questions into this.
No, what I said is that Job isn't asking theological questions.
Okay.
This chapter isn't asking theological questions. It's not that we can't ask theological questions, but I'm saying we can't import them into this chapter.
Well, when he said that it'd be better if he would be in the place of the wicked, I think that the word was. So do they not have a concept of an afterlife at that point?
Sure, but that's not what he's talking about. He's simply talking about at least they're done with this life. At least they're in the grave.
Well, I mean, he's assuming that the afterlife is just going to be peaceful.
No, you're taking it beyond where you need to take it. He's just simply saying, if I'm dead, I'm not experiencing what I'm experiencing now. He's not dealing with where they are after they're dead. He's just saying they're in the grave. They're dead. They're not having to experience the trials and tribulations of this life. Boy, it's tough, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's tough for us not to bring everything we know into this, but we've got to be careful here and realize that we can't do that at this stage. We've got to let it develop as it is. Yeah.
Safe to say that he's not speaking to God here? It sounds like he's just speaking out loud and not so much
That's
directing.
A good way of putting it. He's just simply expressing his pain.
So back to your question.
Good.
Here's where my mind is, moving this to application of today. As a brother and sister, and you see another brother and sister suffering, not to this extent, and you go, say it's a death even, you know, there's true mourning, or maybe it's just something lesser than that, is your question, that's a $1 million question, because there's times where you feel like you should have answers, and their silence is golden. But I've never been one to be silent. But you struggle with that. Mm-hmm. And because my question, trying to figure out your question, is in context, is Job sinning, seeing his state, mental state of sin right now, based, my reason my mind goes there is what we know of the rest of Scripture. Rejoice in all things. Be patient. It's a virtue. All these things. Be content in all situations. He's not expressing that right now. So does that put him, I mean, does it still apply right now? And then back to your question, I'm waiting for an answer.
I know for me, if I'm going through a really difficult time, and I'm telling someone what really helps me a lot the most to start is if they just agree it is hard. What you're going through is hard. And that usually breaks open, you know, to be even receptive to what they're going to say and then if they're going to give you scripture and help you.
There is no single answer to my question. Sometimes the best approach would be 7 more days of silence to what Job had to say. Sometimes it would be just simply saying, yeah, it was hard. I don't have the answers for you. All I know is who God is. that type of thing. I don't know. Boy, I'm going to admit something now. You're going to think of me as somebody different. I don't have the answers. Most of the time I'm trying to minister to people. I'm trying to figure out what they need, but unless and until they tell me, I'm just operating on my past experience, operating on how I would feel if I were in their shoes. I don't know unless God gives me the wisdom to know, and that's what I'm counting on. It's not that I have the answers much of the time when I'm dealing with souls, because we're human beings, we're complex. It's a matter of praying, it's a matter of going to Scripture, it's a matter of trying to grasp what somebody's going through. There is no single answer to the question that I asked. I asked it mainly because I wanted to make us think about it and make us realize that there are some things that we ought not do, which is what we're going to be getting to with these friends.
To me is endurance. We have to endure. Would that be, we don't have an answer. Would that be one perspective of thinking of this, going through these difficult times, enduring it, but knowing that God is, He is.
Well, may I point out that Job is actually honored in the New Testament. It's called the endurance, the patience of Job.
Yeah.
He's enduring.
Yeah. That word came.
Okay, and that's why I would hesitate to charge Job with any sin here. The fact that he's expressing his pain only means that he's expressing his pain. That's all it means. And it's very important for us at this point here in chapter 3 to just simply accept that he's just expressing his pain. Like I said, the problems come later, but let's try and connect with his pain at this point. That's what's going to set, in stark contrast, that's what's going to set these friends where they need to be set, is the fact that here they have had this, like I called it, raw expression of pain. And what are they going to do with it? Well, they did everything wrong with it, as we're going to see here. So we're going to be seeing more about what not to do than about what to do, as far as the book of Job is concerned, until we get to the very end. Okay? Scene 3. Now we finally hear one of the friends start to talk, Eliphaz. And his speech covers chapters 4 and 5 of this book. And you notice when Eliphaz begins to speak, the first thing he expresses is how hesitantly determined he is to speak. Verse 2, if one ventures a word with you, will you become impatient? But who can refrain from speaking? Okay, his hesitation at speaking is because he doesn't think Job can take it. He doesn't think Job is going to be willing to hear him out. His determination to speak, though, is because he feels compelled by the situation. Who can refrain from speaking? In other words, I have to, he's saying. And then he begins in verse 3 through verse 6 to admonish Job for his response to his circumstances. In other words, Eliphaz is now going to chide Job for what he's just heard Job say in chapter 3. And so he reminds him, verses 3 and 4, he reminds Job of Job's own past ministry to those who have suffered. He says, you've admonished many, you've strengthened weak hands, Job. Your words have helped the tottering to stand, and you've strengthened feeble knees. So, verse 5, now, Job, it's come to you. And here you are, impatient. You're not able to take suffering for yourself, Job, Eliphaz says. My, what a comfort he is, huh? And then verse 6, Eliphaz questions Job's failure to depend on his fear of God and his integrity to get him through. This sounds good. Let me read it. Is not, he says to Job, is not your fear of God your confidence? Is not the integrity of your ways your hope? That sounds good, doesn't it? Is there anything wrong with that? Cheryl.
It seems like your hope should be in not in yourself, but in God alone. Not in your holiness and not in your blamelessness, but it's in God alone.
Okay, already we're getting a hint of what's going to be seen time after time after time. Basically, Eliphaz is saying to Job, Job, you ought to be trusting in where you are. In your own spirituality, your confidence is in the integrity of your ways. That's what he's suggesting. It's not in the person of God. It's in how righteous, how upstanding, how upright you are, how blameless you are, Job. Is that not where your confidence is? Isn't that where it should be, he's suggesting? Boy, Job, the book of Job just really blows to smithereens a lot of wrong thinking that we've done, doesn't it? So then in verse 7, all the way through chapter 5, verse 16, then Eliphaz begins to explain his understanding of Job's circumstances. And he does so with the principle of what we could call retribution. Notice now verse 7. He introduces that principle immediately with a rhetorical question. Remember now, who ever perished being innocent? Where were the upright destroyed? Job, can you tell me, whoever perished innocently, whoever perished without deserving it? And he bases that question completely on his own observation, his personal observation, verse 8. According to what I have seen, those who plow iniquity and those who sow trouble harvest it. Trouble comes to those who deserve it. And he attributes that directly to God's control. By the breath of God, verse 9, they perish. And by the blast of his anger, they come to an end. And he illustrates it graphically by the world of the lions, interestingly enough, verses 10 and 11. The roaring of the lion and the voice of the fierce lion and the teeth of the young lion. Young lions are broken. The lion perishes for lack of prey, and the whelps of the lioness are scattered. So what Eliphaz is basically going to be saying throughout here is, Job, you are a sinful man. That's the only explanation reasonable, only explanation possible for what you've endured. You are a sinful man. And guess what happens to sinful people? Trouble. And the depth of your trouble shows the depth of your sinfulness, is what he's saying. And to supposedly continue to prove his point, he explains his understanding of Job's circumstances with the revelation of how unrighteous man is. Verse 12. In verses 12 through 16, by the way, he gives the setting for that revelation that has come to him about man's unrighteousness. So he says, "Now a word was brought to me stealthily, and my ear received a whisper of it." Can you see this happening? Oh, I love to picture all of this on a stage. You notice that with the scenes and the acts and so on. But I just picture what could be happening if we did this as a play. It'd be one long play, wouldn't it? But here Eliphaz is saying, listen, Job, God revealed something to me. It was brought to me stealthily. My ear just heard the whisper of it. Amid disquieting thoughts from the visions of the night when deep sleep falls on men. In other words, I was lying in my bed and all of a sudden it came to me. And dread, verse 14, it came to me in a spooky manner, now he's going to say. Dread came upon me and trembling and made all my bones shake. And then a spirit passed by my face. The hair of my flesh bristled up. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. There was some form before my eyes. There was something there, but oh, it was so nebulous. There was silence, and then I heard a voice. You see what Eliphaz is doing? He's making this seem as realistic as possible. He's making himself seem as spiritual as possible. Oh, God spoke to me in a marvelous way. It scared me to death, you know. That kind of nonsense. I don't know about you. I've heard people do that in our day. Some of them are behind pulpits. So finally, verse 17, we get to the content of this revelation. Here's what this voice spoke to me in the night. Here's what it said. Can mankind be just before God? Can a man be pure before his Maker? These are rhetorical questions, obviously. He's expecting a no way answer. Can't happen. And he proves the point by saying, verse 18, God puts no trust even in his servants, and against his angels he charges error. Not even God's angels are perfect, Eliphaz says. And I don't think he's just speaking of Satan and his hosts. I think he's speaking primarily of what we would call the good, the holy angels. And his point is that God is so holy that even his angels are impure. Much less, verse 19 begins, much less man, who's mortal. How much more those who dwell in houses of clay? If the good angels can't stand in God's presence and compare themselves to God, how much less man, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed before the moth? Between morning and evening, man is broken in pieces. Unobserved, they perish forever. Is not their tent cord plucked up within them? They die, yet without wisdom. So his whole point is, look, mankind's sinful, and that's why mankind experiences what we do. And the fact that your experience is so horrible, Job, shows that your sin is really, really horrible. Whatever it is, notice he doesn't charge Job with anything specific because he can't. But he just knows it's got to be sin behind what Job has done. Mike.
So are we assuming that what's his name?
Eliphaz.
That, I mean, what he's relating actually happened to him, and he's relating it to Job? And if so, I mean, Is the whisper that he heard, was that actually from Satan telling him to, you know, giving him ammunition to throw at Job?
I'm not pretending to know how it happened. I'm not pretending to know whether it was just his imagination because he had too much pizza, or whether it was Satan. To me, it doesn't make any difference. Mm-hmm. It's not true. And that's what I would...
It's not
the
true.
The charge that he's making is not true.
Okay. Right.
He's using some true points. I mean, God does judge sin. Okay? And so we've got to recognize that he's using some truth, but he's using it in a wrong way. And that's what we're going to keep coming back to as we go through these speeches.
But can we assume that Satan is using... Job's friends and Job's wife to try and bring about the cursing of Job from Job of God?
We're not told that, so no, I'm not going to assume that. Satan's already lost. And so I'm not... Satan is out of the picture from now on. He's not included in the text anymore. Okay,
oh,
so I don't see any reason for us to bring him into the text.
So from this point on, I mean, Satan is not still trying to get Job to...
We are not told that he is at work anymore. I'm not saying he is or he isn't. I'm just saying he's not in the picture anymore. He's not addressed. He's done as a character in this drama.
At what point did Satan lose?
He lost at 2 points. He lost in chapter 1, and then he lost again in chapter 2.
Okay, in chapter 2, well, maybe I'm going back, but I thought Satan was still working. I mean, Satan still has the opportunity to get Job to curse God.
That may be, but that's not what we find in the rest of the book of Job, is my point.
Okay.
Satan is not any longer a character involved in this drama. We're not told about him. Whether he was or not, in other words, isn't for us to speculate.
But I wonder if what Mike's getting to is, you know, the second time that Satan talked with God, God said that, you know, stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will, or no, Satan said that. Stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to his face. So, I mean, isn't he still in that trial of Satan telling God to, you know, touch Job's body?
That may be, but my point is that we're not told that here in the book of Job. The test of Satan was lost finally in chapter 2, verse 10, when we are told specifically, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. That is the statement, Satan lost again. And as I've been saying, from this point forward, Satan is not a part of this drama. And so I'm not saying he wasn't active. I'm just saying we can't put things into the text. We got to get what's there and bring it out of the text. Okay? Thank you.
Oh, I was just thinking, I forget exactly how the story goes, but it's in the New Testament where there was a blind fellow, and didn't some people come around and say, ask Jesus, is this man blind? I forget, is it because he has sinned or because his parents had sinned or something like that? I forget how it goes exactly, but you know, basically Jesus said, no,
right,
it's not the case. It's just something God's doing, that whatever. So just thinking of a New Testament parallel here.
The danger of assumptions. Yeah, the danger of assumptions. Okay, I still see that there's confusion, and so I'll try and restate what I've been trying to restate here. I am not saying that Satan isn't active in the rest of this story. I'm saying that he is not being described in the rest of the book of Job. He's out of the picture in that sense. And so all I'm saying is, let's not bring him back in as a major character. He may or may not be working through these three friends, but whether he is or not is not what the book of Job is trying to tell us. Okay? That's all I'm trying to point out, is let's take it for what it is saying and not keep putting stuff into it.
So you're saying that, I mean, it's the book of Job is laid out chronologically. Is that what you're saying then? Because I had wondered if chapter 2 was just telling us kind of the end, that Job didn't curse, and then it went through and started told us the details of it in those chapters 3 and on.
Chapters 1 and 2 tell us the first act, and that's another reason why I like to divide it into acts. The first act lays down the setting. It's the challenge that Satan gives to God. That challenge is done. That question that Satan has raised has been answered. Now as we come to the middle of chapter 2, on through most of the rest of the book of Job, we come to it with the realization that, okay, we know that the relationship between God and those who are his people is not based on a business model. It's not based on a give and take like Satan had charged. What we have not yet learned is, what is it based on? And that's where the rest of the book of Job comes in. What is it based on? And now we have the three friends suggesting that it's based basically on the give and take model again. Only now it's not from the positive side like Satan had been attacking. Now it's from the negative side. Job, you sinned. That's why this happened. They're still viewing it all. So we've seen the wrong view in heaven with Satan. Now we're seeing the wrong view on earth with the friends. But this time it's being presented in order that as we continue to go through the book, we will begin to grab the answer of What is the relationship between God and his people based on? We don't have the answer yet. We're not going to get the answer until the end, I have to warn you. But that's what's going on. So we're moving along in progression here. We're not still dealing with the problem that took place between God and Satan. That's been resolved. Now we're dealing with the problem between the friends and God, and between what'll happen is the problem between Job and God as well, brought on by Job. But it's a different setting. Susan, finally.
I was thinking that another explanation might be to think about like the Diary of Anne Frank. It was the author chose to focus on Anne Frank's experience of the war, and that was what the author drew out. It was still all going on, yet the book was about Anne Frank's experience of it. So in some ways it might help to think about Job, the author, God, has said, think about this and not about what Satan might be doing or whatever, everything else that's going on. But the lesson he wanted us to learn was experience of Job in that. So that might be helpful in thinking about the author's intention. It doesn't mean the rest of it doesn't exist. It's just that this is where the spotlight is for this experience, this book.
Spotlight is a good word. Good word. Okay. Well, I am not going to begin with chapter 5, but I will just describe it briefly. Can't do it. I will just simply say that chapter 5, if you want to read it in preparation for next week, we'll spend a little bit of time in it. That's where Eliphaz is going to give Job his recommended course of action. But remember, it is a recommended course of action based on the theory that Job is a sinful man. Okay, that's Eliphaz's whole contention. You're suffering because you sinned. And therefore, this is what I think you ought to do about it. So read chapter 5 this week with that in mind, and I think you'll come to, I can't say an appreciation of it, but an understanding of it, perhaps greater than you had before. Okay, we got about 1 minute if there's a question that can't wait. A comment that can't wait.
I think I'm just trying to get my mind around this as well, like Eliphaz's speech. I don't even know exactly what my question is, but just kind of a reiteration maybe. It's very confusing to listen because, and you mentioned this, what he's saying is true, I think. In one sense, Job is a sinner. Whatever sins he's committed in his life probably led to suffering in his own life and the lives of those around him. But it's a misuse of truth in this situation. Can you just say a sentence or two beyond that to explain that a bit further? Are you saying the suffering that has come into his life now is not a direct fruit of his sin? Even though he is a sinful man and he has sinned in his life, his family was taken, his flocks were lost, his life, his personal health was taken, not because of that sin.
Exactly.
Is that right?
That's what God said in chapter 2, verse 3, when he said, without cause.
Right.
That's exactly what God was meaning, was that all of this experience that we've read about in chapters 1 and 2 that has come upon Job, has come upon him without cause as far as anything that Job said, thought, or did. It came only, we can tell because we have read those two chapters, we know it came upon him only because of what had happened in heaven. And God had given Satan permission to do all that because God had a bigger picture in mind.
Yeah, that's good. Because when you listen to Eliphaz's speech, you think, yeah, you are a sinner, Job. And yet it's tricky because it's off base in this situation. So it's truth used in the wrong way. I liked how you worded that.
Yeah, and we're going to be getting that lesson, so to speak, more and more as we continue. And that's why I haven't harped on it too much today, because it's just going to keep coming back. These friends are going to be saying a lot of truth, but it is truth being misused. And that should make us very cautious. And at some point here, if I haven't told you about a dear friend of mine, when I first became a pastor, something happened to him. I'll tell you about it at some point here, because from the earliest days of my pastoral ministry, the message of Job here has become very real because of the heartbreak of that friend of mine, because people were misusing this very truth that these friends were misusing. I saw the damage. And it can be great. So the point is, we need to know truth, but we also need to see truth in the big picture. Basically, what I'm saying is we need to see God, but that'll all come out as we go. Father, as we struggle with this, this is a different form of literature for us, and this is a different way of approaching things for us. So as we struggle with this, would you continue to work in us and enlighten our minds, and may it be a good struggle. For your glory, I pray, in Jesus' name.